Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
You know, it's been about a week now, a week and a half, in fact, since LeBron announced that he was going to become a Los Angeles Laker. And there's still this debate as to how he's going to be received. Will Laker fans ever truly accept him? We saw at least a Laker fan deface a mural the other day. You know, the guy's not LeBron. Is he going to be accepted here? Is he going to be welcomed here? It's an ongoing question. I think we got our answer yesterday. Blaze Pizza, a fast food pizza chain that LeBron has invested in, tweeted that they would be giving out free pizza yesterday to celebrate LeBron's arrival. That's one thing. Except LeBron steps in and he retweets it with the following comment. Quote, haven't been to a pizza party in a minute. Culver City, with a couple of emojis. So that got people hyped. And that got people thinking that he was going to show up at the Blaze Pizza in Culver City. Sorry, did I say that got people hyped? They actually lost their collective bleep over that, with the possibility that LeBron might actually show up. As Tori Hart from Yahoo tweeted, quote, hundreds of people are lined up outside Blaze Pizza in Culver City, one since 7:30 a.m., awaiting at King James's potential arrival. Franchise owner Tom Cook has no idea if or when he's coming, found out about it the same way we all did. End quote. All right, notice I said people showing up at 7:30 in the morning. 7:30 in the morning for pizza, for LeBron. Let me tell you something. I grew up in Los Angeles. I'm a native of Los Angeles. Nobody in LA ever shows up early for anything, ever. The rule in LA is, if you're 20 minutes late, you're a half hour early. And these folks are rolling into Culver City at 7:30 a.m. for an event that's not supposed to start until 2 p.m.? I mean, that's like the middle of the night. That is so early. I can't even count how many hours early that is. 6.5 hours early for free pizza and a possible glimpse of LeBron. What? Did camping out the night before seem a little over the top? I also understand, being that I'm from LA, that LA loves the idea of free is me, and that you could give away garbage. No, I mean literal garbage. And as long as it says free, people will show up for garbage. As long as it's free. But this is over the top. I mean, this is extreme. And it shows how much people do love LeBron. And that's before the guys even put on Laker gear. There were kids with signs, people with wacky cars, and of course, lots and lots of Laker gear, lots of Laker jerseys. I'm guessing the crew that showed up and waited for hours for a glimpse of LeBron probably was not that same crew that vandalized his mural in Venice. And then, when a couple of nice cars did roll up, people freaked out, ran right at them, thinking it was LeBron. Spoiler alert, it was not. In fact, LeBron never did show. He never did show. And honestly, if you really read that tweet, he hinted that he was coming, but he certainly did not say that he was coming. I mean, it would have been cool if he did. But if anything else, I think yesterday answered the question of whether or not Laker fans are going to embrace LeBron, whether or not Laker fans love LeBron. They do. They already love the guy. They love LeBron like they love hyping Josh Hart Summer League highlights, which is to say a lot, an enormous amount. And if this guy does show up for a pizza party somewhere, that place is going to explode. So yeah, I think those people who were claiming that LeBron would get booed at Staples are wrong. Because if Laker fan is rolling this deep for fast-fired pizza in the middle of the day or early in the morning, in the middle of the week, just because of a LeBron tweet, I think it's going to be just fine. If they're this hyped about free pizza, imagine what's going to happen when this guy starts winning games and winning fans free tacos. This front-running town will come off the rails altogether. That answers your question. They're into the guy. They love the guy. They're all about the guy. If they're showing up in the middle of the night with a chance to get a glimpse of the guy, now you know. GM David Forrest is my guest. David, really nice to have you on the show. Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. It's an honor to be in the jungle. How you doing?
It's great to have you in the jungle, David. Great to have you. I'm doing great. Thanks so much. You had a tough one last night. The Astros had that walk-off tapper in front of the plate in the 11th. I mean, those kind of things, David, are going to happen over the course of a 162-game season. But does a game like that sting a little bit more than a regular season loss, or do you just put that in the past and focus on tonight as quickly as you can?
You know, actually, I think it's the opposite. I think our guys were focused more on the comeback, four runs in the ninth, going ahead in the 11th, and then just kind of a fluke thing that let that one get away from us. But, you know, we've played so well of late. We've worked our bullpen pretty hard, and it was bound to happen. But I think our guys were focused on all the right things after the game.
All right, so I'm going to get to that bullpen in a minute. But last season, you ended up by winning 17 of your final 24. And I spoke with Bob Melvin in spring training, and the optimism was very clear. So how important was it to close out last year the way you did? And then what kind of expectations did you have coming into this season?
Yeah, I think that was a great start for this group. You know, we brought up a number of the young players, Matt Chapman, Matt Olson, Chad Pinder, all came up late in the year, and we played really well to close it out. And I think everybody had a good feeling going into the off season, and they certainly have built on that momentum. And we've got a couple of veterans in the middle of the lineup, Jed Lowry and Chris Davis, who are kind of the anchors of our lineup. But the young guys got a little taste of winning late last year, and it's carried over. It's been great.
David Forrest joining us. So you're right in the hunt right now. You're 10 games over 500. Did you expect to be where you are right now, or maybe are you running a little ahead of schedule, especially when you consider some of the injuries that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, considering the starting pitching injuries, it's hard to imagine we would have been here. If you told me, you know, Edwin Jackson and Brett Anderson were in our rotation in July, I'm not sure I would have guessed that we were going to be 10 games over. But we knew coming into the year that we had a good offense. We were going to score some runs, and we really felt like the bullpen was going to be a strength. We added Ryan Buchter, added Emilio Pagan. We thought Lou Trevino would be a contributor at some point. So we knew there were some things we did well, and if the starting pitching could keep us in games, we were going to have a chance, and that's been exactly the formula all year.
A's GM David Forrest joining us here in the jungle. All right, speaking of that bullpen, you did a segment of mean tweets in the offseason as part of Giving Tuesday. It really was funny. Among the gems was this: Bob Melvin probably dreams of smothering David Forrest with a pillow for giving him this trash bullpen. End of quote. And one more: I wouldn't recommend waiting for a Michael Lewis book and movie about David Forrest. Quote, end of quote. You handled that segment like a pro, but is there any part of you now that wants to say, hey, everybody, we are right in line for a postseason spot. Where are your mean tweets today?
I did have fun doing that, and Dallas Braden was with me, and he hosted it great. But look, I've been here, this is my 19th year. I know the ups and downs. The nice thing is we have passionate fans, and Oakland fans get a bad rap because of our attendance, and we play in an old building. But the fans who do come out care. They care deeply about this club, and it's part of the gig to take some ribbing once in a while. But look, we knew we had to address the bullpen, and we feel like we've done a good job with that.
Hey, listen, you spent 19 years there. You just made that point. I mean, you've had other opportunities. You could have gone elsewhere. What is it that makes that opportunity and that organization so unique that you never have left?
Yeah, I've been really lucky, and you know, first of all, working with Billy has been great. I mean, he brought me in here; he's given me every opportunity. So working with Billy has been the number one thing, and you know, the organization treats people well. We have people here who've been here literally since the day the team moved from Kansas City. Our clubhouse manager Steve Vucinich has been here for 50 years, so people enjoy here. As a SoCal guy, it's hard to say I love living up here in NorCal, but I do. My family loves it here, and there's just never been a good reason to leave.
David Forrest joining us. All right, you mentioned Edwin Jackson. I got to ask you about him. He was signed to a deal earlier this season and then was called up last month, and he got the start against Detroit. In doing so, he tied the MLB record for most teams played for at 13, and since he's been with you, he's been solid, 1-0 record, and ERA 2.45. I mean, what's that tell you about his professionalism and what he brings to your team?
You're exactly right. I mean, I didn't know Edwin at all before we called him up. I've had a chance to talk to him. He fits in well everywhere. I can totally see why he's been able to bounce around like he has. He's a pro. You know, he enjoys being around his teammates. He enjoys meeting new guys. And he's got a track record of success. So he's been a perfect guy to have here. And I certainly hope the success on the mound keeps rolling.
All right, so knowing where you are right now, and you've got to look at a postseason bid, how do you approach the trade deadline?
Well, I think first of all, we got a few weeks to go. We're going to get through the break. We've got two more games against Houston, six against the Giants, and then we'll see where we're at. But, you know, this group deserves a chance to stay together. They deserve a chance to play this thing out. I think we know here how precious playoff opportunities are, and you don't just punt them because you're a little bit ahead of schedule or maybe didn't expect to be here. So, there have been a lot of comparisons made between this team and the 2012 team that kind of came out of nowhere, and it remains to be seen how that plays out over the last couple months. But this group likes each other. They enjoy playing together, and I think we're going to go into the next 3 weeks feeling like, hey, let's see if we can stick together, hold this group and maybe even, help them out a little bit.
There are a million things demanding your time. Contact lenses should not be one of them. With Simple Contacts, you can renew your prescription and reorder your contacts from anywhere in just minutes. No more doctor's offices or waiting rooms. You take a 5-minute vision test from your phone or computer. It's reviewed by a licensed doctor. You receive a renewed prescription and reorder your contacts. All you need is your current contacts, an internet connection, and 10 feet of space. Do you have an unexpired prescription? Just upload a photo or your doctor's info and order your lenses. Instead of heading to the doctor every single year to renew your prescription, take a few minutes out of your day and do it on your own time and your own terms. Please note, this is not a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam. It is vision care for the 21st century. The vision test is only $20. The contact lens prices are unbeatable. Standard shipping is free. And best of all, we are offering a promotion for our listeners. Get $30 off your contacts at simplecontacts.com/Rome or enter code Rome at checkout. Once again, $30 off your contacts at simplecontacts.com/Rome or enter Rome at checkout. We're talking to David Forrest and getting ready for that as well. David, you played your college baseball at Harvard, as I mentioned off the top. Then you were in the Frontier League. What were those days like for you as a player?
I loved playing. I wanted to be here in Oakland as a player growing up and playing college ball and then a little bit independent. And, I got to play 2 years independent ball and kind of get it out of my system and realize, all right, it's not going to happen for me on the field. But it was a great internship for working in baseball because you're riding the buses, you're going to the park every day. And, those years in Springfield were great. I should tell you that I played in Springfield in 98 and I brought my copy of Welcome to the Jungle to the clubhouse.
Love that. Well, that's amazing.
That team in 98 played that CD just about every day before we headed out on the field.
So, that is the best.
That's one of my memories from playing independent ball. It was perfectly timed for your show to go syndicated and then that CD to come out. But it was, like I said, I loved my time on the field. I was one of the rare guys who knew when his time was up and knew it was time to move into the front office.
Good, David, that is such a great story. I really appreciate you sharing that. So now, you grew up in Encino, right? Did you play Encino Little League?
I sure did. My folks live about a block and a half from that field.
All right, now that's a really, really good Little League. What was it like back then?
It was competitive. I grew up there playing on the field. There were a bunch of guys who were a year or two older than me that went on to play D1 at SC and UCLA and go play pro ball. And there are a lot of good names, a lot of good ball players who came out of that park.
Yeah, I wonder, is Reggie Smith still down there? We don't live there anymore, but I can remember he was holding court there for a long, long time.
He was, yep. When I was growing up, he was given hitting lessons there. He was running camps out of Encino Little League. He was a legend around those parts.
818 for life, David Forrest joining us. I actually played Sherman Oaks Little League, which was all right, but it was not Encino Little League. Definitely not.
Yeah, I think you were a little ahead of me, but by the time I was there, like I said, there were some good players.
All right, so before you go, let me ask you this. You were a non-roster invitee to the Red Sox camp in 1999, and then you were released, and then you went back to the Frontier League. So then you probably start to think, well, maybe I want to stay in baseball. There are other things to do. Because you've been on the other side of that table, now that you sit where you sit, what's it like when you have to have a hard conversation with a player?
Yeah, I think that experience was huge in sort of helping me empathize with the guys in uniform. I was there for 3 weeks. I was basically 4 years older than anybody else who I was working out with, and it made total sense that I got released. But I at least went through that experience and understand, particularly the minor league guys, what their mindset is, how badly they want this, and how devastating it is when they, get sent down, don't get promoted, or get released. And hopefully, over my time here, it has allowed me to, kind of be in their shoes and help them out a little bit along the way.
David Forrest joining us. One last thought then. In this year's draft, of course, you selected Kyler Murray in the first round. Many people know he's competing to be the starting quarterback at Oklahoma, which does carry with it some risk. So what did you see in him that made you feel like he was somebody that you wanted in that spot, despite that risk?
This guy is just an outstanding athlete, just an incredible talent, and a guy who basically went out with about 100 plate appearances in the last 3 years and raked at Oklahoma his junior year. And you can see the skills, you can see the talent anytime you go watch him play. And we were just kind of blown away as a staff by what he's capable of, what his upside is, and, you know, ultimately, we just have to kind of hold our breath for the next 6 months. I'm not a huge college football fan, but I will be watching OU every Saturday this fall and keeping my fingers crossed he stays healthy.
No doubt. I got to think, even at the highest level where you are right now, David, you've got to have such great memories of playing college baseball. Do you stay in contact with a lot of your college teammates? And as you think back, was that not one of the best times of your life?
Absolutely. Yeah, those are my best friends in the world right now, the guys I played with at Harvard. We just had our 20th college reunion last month, and you keep in touch. You talk about, you know, the teams, the winning teams are the ones that you remember. We won the Ivy League my junior and senior year, went to a regional. We beat UCLA in a regional in 97 at Oklahoma State, and I still run into guys like Eric Burns, Eric Valent, Troy Glass, and I get to remind them we beat them in a regional. So those were absolutely the best times.
Dude, seriously. How sweet is that? How good does that feel, especially when you run into monsters like that? How good did that feel to beat those guys?
It's good. Burnsy was here when I first started in 2000. Burnsy was in the organization. I talk to him all the time. He pops into spring training, and he knows. He knows I've got that over him.
Yeah, I keep trying to let you go, but one final thought about Burnsy. I'd love to say that every clubhouse has one, but it doesn't, right? How unique a character and player was Eric Burns?
Amazing. I mean, we knew it when he was here that he was one of a kind, and he's only sort of increased that status as the years have gone on with his act on MLB Network. He's running, you know, those Uber triathlons or whatever they are. He's writing books. He's a pretty unique guy, and it was fun to be around him as a player, and I've enjoyed staying in touch with him over the years.
Oakland is ahead of schedule. They're 10 games over 500. They've got another shot at Houston tonight. They're 51-41. Their GM, David Forrest, my guest. David, I love that story about the Welcome to the Jungle CD. Thanks so much for that. Good to finally have you on the show. We got to do it again soon.
Absolutely, Jim. I really enjoy talking to you.
The Hump Day edition of the Daily Jungle is brought to you by Fan Exchange. Clones, there are a ton of huge artists on tour this summer. The Pixies, Weezer, Eminem, Pearl Jam, plus the festival circuit. Fan Exchange has all the tickets. Tickets purchased on Fan Exchange are always guaranteed. No getting to the gate and worrying about getting in. Fan Exchange gets you closer to the action. Find the very best seats at the very best prices at fanexchange.com. Use the promo code ROME. That's promo code ROME and get 50% off the service fees on your next purchase. Fan Exchange. We have tickets. Fan Exchange, promo code ROME. So let's talk about LeSean McCoy for a minute. It's been a pretty disturbing and confusing 24 hours involving LeSean McCoy. Yesterday, a post surfaced on Instagram with two photos of his estranged girlfriend, one of which was her lying bloodied in a hospital bed yesterday morning. Horrible picture. I mean, a truly horrible picture. The post, allegedly from a friend of the woman, accused McCoy of being, quote, the devil. You are an animal. We didn't say anything about how you beat your dog, Henny, into kidney failure. Let's not talk about all the times my best friend had to stop you from viciously beating your son for small things like peeing in the bed. We kept quiet about your drug usage, all the illegal steroids and needles you were using. But we will not keep quiet about this. End quote. Allegedly beating a dog into kidney failure. Allegedly beating his son. Allegedly using roids. These are some incredibly serious allegations. And so are the allegations connected to the photo. The photo is graphic. The photo is brutal. The photo is extremely disturbing. Now, McCoy, for his part, posted a statement on social media that read, quote, "For the record, the totally baseless and offensive claims made against me today on social media are completely false. Furthermore, I have not had any direct contact with any of the people involved in months." End quote. Now, the original Instagram post of the alleged victim has been removed, but it was replaced with one that said that the victim's lawyers requested it be removed and, quote, I stand by what I said. I personally addressed McCoy on everything that was stated many, many times over the years. Lie to these people if you want, Shady, but you know I know everything. End quote. As always, and especially when accusations and denials are being issued on social media, it is hard to know what is and what is not accurate. So here's what else we do know. There's an active police investigation into a home invasion which took place early Tuesday morning at a property owned by McCoy. During that home invasion, McCoy's estranged girlfriend was allegedly beaten and robbed. In a statement to the media, the police said, quote, "The preliminary investigation indicates that this residence was specifically targeted by the suspect or suspects and not a random incident. When officers arrived, they found one victim who had been physically assaulted by a lone intruder. During the altercation, the suspect demanded specific items from the victim," end quote. The victim's attorney said that the victim was sleeping in the house when an assailant entered and demanded, quote, "specific items of jewelry," end quote, that she had received from McCoy. The attorney said that the assailant bruised the victim's wrists as he attempted to remove her bracelet, struck her in the head with a weapon. The attorney also alleges that McCoy had told the victim that he wanted the jewelry back. So, it's a really complicated and confusing story, and it's one that's obviously going to take time to play out. One that's going to take time to get to the bottom of. But the photo is awful, and the allegations are too. Now, nobody's alleging that McCoy carried out the attack. He was training in Florida at that time. But it doesn't look great for him that the attacker allegedly demanded specific items from the victim that McCoy himself had allegedly asked for in the past. Also doesn't look great that there was no forced entry. And the statement that he released on social media is weird. To me, it's weird. Look, I've never been in a situation like this. I don't know the ins and outs of their relationship. But he doesn't seem especially concerned about somebody breaking into a house that he owns and attacking somebody that he allegedly knows. Doesn't seem all that concerned about any of that. Again, a lot of it's speculation at this point. And speculation, especially in a situation like this, is extremely dangerous and unhelpful. And it's probably also not helpful that Richie Incognito is the guy jumping in on Twitter to declare, and I quote, this is Richie Incognito, quote, "prayers up for my G at Cut on Dime 25. I know the whole story. You good to go, family. I love you, my G. Hashtag always and forever." Thanks for that, Richard. Hey, look, I get that you want to have your guys back, but maybe you take a breather on this play before declaring that you know the whole story and that McCoy is, quote, good to go. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he knows more than most, but does he know the whole story? Maybe. Maybe not. At this point, it'd be hard to say that anybody knows the whole story, but apparently Richie Incognito does. And in my mind, we really don't need to let justice run its course because, as Richard states, his G is, quote, good to go. Oh, always and forever. Except for one problem. The police aren't saying that, and neither is the NFL, which is also investigating. Once again, I'm never the guy to rush in with the hammer or mash my keyboard or iPhone with a definitive statement. Because without more information, I don't have one. So I'm never going to go off half-cocked. Never have, never will. But I can definitely say this much. It looks bad. It looks really, really bad. And unlike Richie Incognito, I am not prepared to say that McCoy is, quote, good to go. I mean, who knows, right? Who knows? He may be closer to having played his last down than he is to playing his next. We just don't know. Only thing we do know is that there are going to be a lot more twists and turns to this story, and it's probably not going to be pretty. no matter what Richie Incognito says. How much better and easier is your life when you can take care of something online? How much worse then is your life when you're turning the house upside down looking for a stamp? Stamps.com is the easiest way to access all the amazing services of the post office. I've got a business. I need the post office. I use Stamps.com. It saves me time. It saves me money. It makes my life so much easier. And it can do the same thing for you. Create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. Click, print, mail, and you're done. Again, Stamps.com brings all the amazing services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. I'll tell you why I use Stamps.com. It's easy. It's fast, it's convenient, and we're all looking for an edge. We're all looking for more time. This helps me save time. And right now, you too can enjoy Stamps.com with a special offer, which includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Rome. Stamps.com, enter Rome. Charles Robinson. Charles, good to have you back. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, brother. How are you doing today?
Good, good, man. Great to talk to you. Thanks so much. Let's go back to yesterday morning. What was your initial reaction when you saw the Instagram post alleging that LaShawn McCoy had some level of involvement in a home invasion where his estranged girlfriend was assaulted?
I mean, just shock. You know, the brutality of the photo, you know, was pretty unbelievable. And you know, knowing that this was someone that was living in a home owned by LaShawn McCoy, pretty, you know, 6,000 square foot, beautiful home, north of Atlanta. You know, instantaneously, you know, this is going to be a pretty problematic situation for LaShawn McCoy, particularly knowing that there was a protracted legal battle between the two parties, that LaShawn McCoy had been trying to get this ex-girlfriend out of his house for a while now. And, you know, for something like this to happen at 3 a.m, obviously we learned more details as the day went on. Pretty stunning, and I think it was also one of those moments where over the years you've heard all these complaints about why the NFL has its own team involved in investigating domestic violence. Well, you know, that photo showed us why. I mean, because of the furor that is created when something like that pops up, the NFL just does not have the luxury of sitting by and letting authorities sort it out before getting their own feet on the ground.
All right, so that's a really key point, which I want to go back to in 1 minute. But the photo goes viral, and as you wrote, quote, in the space of a few hours, the NFL had a star player confronted with brutal accusations without having any idea whether McCoy was involved or not, end quote. So purely from a reporter standpoint, how do you go about dealing with a story like that?
Well, I mean, it was bananas. You had a number of outlets, you know, that were carrying the accusation, you know, on Twitter and Facebook and every other social media platform. There's already sort of a solidification amongst some readers of guilt or innocence. And the reality was, we didn't even know what the details were. I called the Milton Police Department, and to my surprise, a few hours into this, there hadn't even been a fully fleshed out police report created to be released. And, you know, so in that situation, I think you just have to approach it from a factual standpoint. Look, yes, this is his house. Yes, this is his ex-girlfriend. But the next question is, number one, where's LaShawn McCoy right now? Where was he when this supposedly happened? Number two, what are the details of the incident? And then you move on from there. And I think that's sort of what happened yesterday. As details came out, we came to find out that, you know, LaShawn McCoy provably was in another state. He was in the state of Florida. You know, had evidence to back that up. You know, provably this was another individual that was in the home and committed this assault and robbery. But then we also learned things like there was no forced entry. You know, this was a house that was locked and had a security system that had been replaced by LaShawn McCoy recently, and yet someone was able to gain entry to that house, according to the attorney of the victim, without forced entry. But it's so early now. We're still waiting on, you know, some of the details of the investigation from both the police department. And then on top of that, you have basically everybody's lawyering up. LaShawn McCoy has hired a high-profile defense attorney in Atlanta by the name of Don Samuel, who's pretty well-respected in Atlanta legal circles. The alleged victim has her own attorney, and I think we're going to start that sort of public relations battle that begins on top of concurrent investigations, both by the NFL Domestic Violence Unit and then also the Atlanta Police Department.
Charles Police Department. Robinson, Yahoo Sports, senior NFL reporter, excuse me. Let me go back to your other point, too. You know, as you write, a few years back, an agent was very irritated because his player was being visited by legal investigators regarding an allegation made by a former girlfriend and raised the question, why is the league investigating something that the local police can or should be investigating? So how would you answer that question?
Well, you know, I would say up front, you've heard that frustration for a number of years, whether it's from teams or players or, you know, the agents of players or lawyers or whoever, essentially saying, look, this process is so opaque. I have, someone showing up from Lisa Friel, who's the lead investigator for domestic violence cases for the league, essentially dispatches an investigator out to wherever an NFL team is or wherever a player might live to ask questions saying, hey, look, there's this allegation that's been sort of levied against you. I need to ask you some questions about this. And then the complaint that you usually hear is, we don't know what's going on. What does this mean? Is there an investigation? Is this open? Is it closed? How long is this going to drag on? Do we need to, you know, mount a defense right now? You know, so I get that complaint. But as I wrote, look, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when the Ray Rice incident happened and then the tape came out, the world changed for the NFL. It realized we can't sit by and let someone else handle this process and then dictate what our sort of outcome is going to be on this end based on legal matters. Sometimes we feel like legal matters don't meet the standard that we want. And, you know, at least partially from a PR standpoint, we need to have our own in-house investigative unit to get that. I think on Tuesday you saw why, because a picture went out there and it was everywhere. Within a couple of hours, it was, you know, coast to coast, every website. It was the biggest story in the NFL and it was stunning. And we didn't even know whether there was provable guilt or innocence or really even what some of the details were. So the NFL in a situation like that, we know now why they can't wait, because of what happened on Tuesday. They have to have an instantaneous movement behind closed doors to start their own process. They can't just sit there and let things sort of sort themselves out.
Charles Robinson joining us. You know, it was amazing to watch that thing when it hit Twitter, to see that thing just kind of snowball and move faster and faster and faster. So how much has social media changed how the league has to respond?
I think it's, you know, pretty significant, particularly in the case, you know, in situations like this where, you know, domestic violence is rightfully a very hot button issue, you know, for the league. And I think that, you know, social media, it in a way solidifies an opinion in one direction or another within, you know, if not hours, minutes, you know, for the NFL. And the NFL is constantly, it's always been so PR forward, but I think more in the last 4 years, whether it's been, you know, what's going on with the national anthem, that being a constant thing, Donald Trump being a constant thing, you know, domestic violence, CTE, these are all issues that play out in real time, you know, and harden opinions, solidify opinions very quickly in social media. I think Donald Trump alone has shown how the NFL has had difficulty sort of dealing with a social media platform. You have someone so powerful who instantaneously can reach out and strike at your league consistently and over again, and the NFL has had a very hard time figuring out how to deal with that, other than now just deciding to ignore the President of the United States. So there's no doubt that it has shaped how the NFL has to defend itself from a public relations standpoint, and I think, you know, you're going to see it's already started. Millions and millions of dollars have been poured into this effort, and that's only going to get bigger as we move forward.
Got a couple of minutes still with Charles Robinson joining us on the show. So what's your sense as to how team owners feel about the way the league handles situations like this? In other words, does it take pressure off of the individual teams, or do they not like the fact that they may lose one of their players for a number of games?
I think it cuts both ways. I think some teams like, so for example, right now the Buffalo Bills have the luxury of saying, look, the NFL has its own unit doing this investigation. We're corresponding with them, but really, you know, we're letting them take the lead. That's how this works. Now, we do have our own team security, but it's not on our team security to really be the lead in this investigation. Instead, we're looking to the league for guidance. That's what we pay this millions of dollars for this investigative unit. And, you know, we're expecting you before training camp to give us some idea exactly what direction this is headed in. But then it can also cut the opposite ways. You know, you have an Ezekiel Elliott case where the Dallas Cowboys felt like lost. They never knew what exactly was going on. Jerry Jones was, you know, I think at times incensed that he was not given more continual updates or what he thought were accurate updates regarding Ezekiel Elliott. So, yeah, you know, I think it's something that really cuts both ways. But I also, what I think is really interesting, what I think a lot of people are missing out now is I think we're starting to see with some of these investigations, the NFL, there's been some pressure from owners to not get into protracted legal battles as they did with Ezekiel Elliott or Tom Brady, start to settle these cases out, offer players the ability, hey, we did the investigation. Instead of getting six games or whatever we may suspend you, don't fight us on it. Take the settlement now. Look at Jameis Winston. Jameis Winston, there should have been a six-game suspension standard. He got three, and I think part of that was the NFL going, here's our evidence. We'll fight you on this. If you want to fight us in court, we'll do that. Or you can settle now, take the three games, and we don't have to go through that projected legal battle, which saves the NFL money but still accomplishes its purposes of having maybe that higher standard that isn't there otherwise.
Got it. Before I let you go, I got to ask you, you tweeted about this. You had a LASIK exam. One of my favorite things ever. I got to ask you, how did that go for you and how are you feeling about the whole process?
It went well so far. I mean, we'll see. I guess I'll have fewer excuses for all the mistakes that I make either watching games or writing about them. So we'll see.
Dude, I got to tell
so
you, man,
far,
don't,
so
let me tell you something.
Hookup, let me know.
Let me tell you something. I did this more than 10 years ago. Literally the best thing ever. I had like a laser fetish after that. I would do it again. I'd pay for it again the morning after when you take those things off. It is the greatest thing ever. I'm telling you, I would do this thing once a year if I could. You have nothing to worry about. It is awesome. You got to
okay.
do it.
Well, you just got to promise me the next segment we do next time, it will be all laser fetish question.
Oh, yeah. The smack off is now just 9 days out. We are officially into a single digit countdown. 9 days until the main event. Now, as you know, I have been profiling the field because I want you to know who these guys are, what they've done, what they're capable of coming up next Friday. I want you to have your scorecard. I want you to have your program. I want you to know what you're listening to because some of you are new to it and have never heard of the smack off. Next Friday is invite only, heavy hitters only, best of the best only. So far, I've ran back Mark in Hollywood, Aya Frady, Stevie Carbone, Chael Sonnen. Today we go international with it. Today we go to Canada. Now, if you've listened to the program for the past year and a half, you no doubt know the names Tyler in Edmonton, Matt in Van. These two dudes have come out of nowhere, and they have become staples in the jungle. And I love it. And I especially love it because they're from Canada. Nothing makes me happier than these two Canadians spitting on the old whack-ass prediction that the jungle would never work in Canada, that the jungle would never play in Canada, that nobody there gives a damn what somebody in California has to say. Because not only does the jungle work in Canada, the jungle thrives in Canada. Matt and Tyler will tell you they have been listening for years. However, they only recently jumped to the phones, and it happened for both of them right around the same time, late in 2016. And in a weird kind of parallel ascent, they both ripped their golden tickets in 2017. They made their smack-off debuts a few months later. Now, we heard those calls a few weeks back when I ran down the soon-to-be sophomores of this year's event. Remember, Tyler took 12th, Matt took 11th. Now, I'll be honest. I didn't even know that we kept track of anything outside the top 10. Probably the nut does that for me. But nobody in the jungle has let these two forget that they did finish outside the top 10, including Benny in Wisco, who got off a couple of weeks back.
Now, here's something to think about. Matt didn't pick the 11th or 12th place finishers last year to have a sophomore slump. So out of the 12 competitors that didn't get run, he didn't pick the last place or the second to last place finishers to do worse than they did last year. Wow! What a risk taker. You could double where I finished last year, and you'd still be looking up at me. And I'll bet you 5,000 pine cones that you'll be looking up at me again. Slump these, Matty.
5,000 pine cones, all pushed to the center of the forest. All right, so since last July, the Canadians have been coming in, and they've been coming in strong, and they have been coming in often. And they graduated from taking runs at Dan in Denver and Jeff in SoCal, and now they're throwing way out of their weight class. Or are they? Because there is no denying it, they are landing. In four different calls this year, Matt and Van has taken runs at Mark in Boston, Jeff in Richmond, Brad in Corona, and even the freaking nut himself.
I need to address these asinine stuck nut smack off odds. This 40-year-old loser has done nothing but record your content for 20 years and put it on his own website, and that's somehow an accomplishment for this virgin. It's pathetic.
And I know you've said numerous times Mark in Boston could win a smack off. And man, you're right. If Les, Vic, Mike, Chael, Benny, Tyler, and myself all pass away before the smack off, then Mark in Boston sure as hell has a chance.
Can we get Jeff a liver smoothie and go ahead and send him the hell away again? Damn, man. And his palatial estate in Virginia. I think we know that was about 10 years in a supermax federal penitentiary for sex crimes, Jeff. And then this panhandler comes in with some scorching hot coin takes and a shared calendar blast for me and Tyler. The only item on our shared calendar, Corona, is Mrs. Corona's scheduled Northern Sando. But Tyler and I agreed to call that off after she DM'd us a pic.
This dude. How is that guy going to finish outside the top 10 again? Now, granted, that was not from one call. That was from four different calls spanning a few months, but it shows that Matt has been shooting at a high volume, that he's been connecting from distance. He's definitely on all of those guys' radars come the 20th. That's Matt and Van. Tyler is no different. Dude has also taken his runs at guys, including Brad in Corona and also Jeff in Richmond.
You know, Brad, coming after my tattoos is only going to make me send more pictures of my other tattoos, which is just going to piss you off even more, and not to mention crank the thirst ratings of the lady quotes to an all-time high. You said something about my arm looking like flesh-eating disease. Brad, what that is muscle tone, and besides that, even if I did have flesh-eating disease, it wouldn't be that surprising, dude, because let's be honest, I'd want to eat me too. Brad, I seen the clip of your call, and you didn't even have a picture up. Bro, what's that all about? Either you're an insecure little bitch or the guys at CBS didn't want the TV audience to see how bad your stretch marks have gotten. All these fossils like Jeff think they have some sort of reinvented game like Big Bart, when all we really have are a bunch of desperate Rafael Palmeiros making a senile jackass out of themselves. And, you know, it's kind of getting awkward listening to them talk about how they used to hang with you back in the day, then you became you, and they became irate. And now we have Jeff in Richmond calling in and taking up an entire segment with his ramblings about nothing. Literally. What did he say besides, and Jim, my sleds, and Jim?
I gotta tell you, these dudes crack me up. Both these dudes crack me up. Both these dudes are unafraid, and there is no denying that they have made the pivot from going after bottom feeders to swinging for the fences. To be the man, you got to beat the man. To be the man, you got to beat the man down. And that's where they're going with it. And now, and I'm sure after this take especially, they're under a lot of people's skin. They're in a lot of people's domes, including all the passive listeners here in America who get called fat every single time one or both of these guys call in.
More good-looking, lean Canadian showing up on your simulcast after January 2nd to break up the onslaught of muffin-top Americans.
America, are you tired of ankle and elbow fat giving you skin rash? You want results without having to sacrifice your hourly trip to your local fast food restaurant? Or are you just too useless to actually commit to a workout that will help you see your own toes again?
Did I seriously hear one of these fat, puffy human cattle email in cracking us for being skinny? Rome, what's next? This guy going to email in and crack on us for having a nice full head of hair or a nice smile for being
being able to pick up the finest women.
Quit filling your cookie jars with Big Macs. Quit putting Pepsi in your cereal.
I'm all for you fat idiots leaning out. Spending money and waking up at 4:30 in the morning to be the best at exercising is next level week.
When you squeeze on that Christmas sweater that you swear fit you last year, don't be embarrassed. Just blame it on the dryer. When you stop at McDonald's on the drive over to the Christmas dinner, be proud. Hold that cheeseburger to the sky and let everyone know that this holiday season, you aren't going to bitch out on that third plate just to be polite.
Warby's sending in a smack-off picture montage to give all these clones a nice succulent treat on smack-off day. Peace.
Hey, listen, I'm, quote, American. I could probably drop a few, spend a little more time throwing the weights around. I don't know, man. These dudes make me laugh. They make me laugh. But I know a lot of you Americans don't think it's very funny at all. You could argue, though, that nobody's got more on the line than these two. A week from Friday, they have run so much junk. They have talked so much junk for such a long time. And a lot of you have tweeted that they're going to gas out by the smack-off. I don't know. I don't know. When I listen to those montages, these guys have got smack for days. I mean, they never run out of ways to call us fat. They never run out of ways to tell us how good-looking they are. And like I said, they're taking big swings now. They're going up to the yard and picking the biggest bully on that yard and saying, let's go. Go? You want to go? Go? Let's do this right now. And they're doing it over and over again. But to me, it's more than just showing up for the Canadians. 14 guys have won this thing. All 14 of them pledge allegiance to the Stars and Stripes. The question now is this. Can one of these two hang a maple leaf from the tallest tree in the jungle come July 20th? What if these guys are like the exacta? What if they go 1-2? What if they went 1-2? What if they both hit the podium even? What if one of them won? You imagine an entire year on this program with a Canadian winner of the smack off. I think these guys have a look. I think they both have a look. In fact, as I'm measuring their games and looking at their games, I'm not sure who's got a better chance. I guess I'll just go to Stuckna and see what the odds are. If you had to guess, number one, can you tell the difference between the two of them? Do you know one from the other? And then number two, who do you think's better? Who's got a better shot? Who's got a better look? Or do you just hate both these guys so much because they're lean and they look good? He is also an MLB Network insider, a ton to talk to Joel Sherman about. Great to have you on. Joel, let me ask you this. There was a lot of buzz about the Yankees potentially making a move for Manny Machado. Then he goes 3-for-4 last night with a couple of home runs against New York. You spoke with Brian Cashman yesterday. He was not that interested in talking about Machado. How would you describe his mood overall, and how is he going to approach the next few weeks before the deadline?
Yeah, so I would think of it a little bit like Brian Cashman needs a couch, has shown up in a furniture store, and there's no couches available.
Right.
What they need most is a high-end starting pitcher. They have one of the best starters in the sport, Luis Severino, and their rotation is a little Gladys Knight in the Pips. He's Gladys Knight, and then there's a bunch of Pips who are not really trustworthy. And as they're trying to track down the Red Sox for the rest of this season and think about playoff series, they'd like someone else to be in there. The only real potential guys you can imagine being in the trade market in the next 3 weeks are Jake DeGrom and Noah Syndergaard from the Mets. A, I don't believe, Jim, that the Mets are hankering certainly to trade DeGrom, and I don't know that there's enough time. Syndergaard hasn't even made it a start yet off of the DL to do it. And then I think if the Mets were ranking 1 to 29, the teams they were most likely to make a trade with, the Yankees would be 29 with a downward-facing bullet. They just don't want to help the team on the other side of the Triborough Bridge. So when it comes to a high-end starting pitcher, that is might not be in this marketplace. And so the question becomes, if you can't stop teams from scoring, do you try to then score more by getting Machado? Or do you try to take what's already, I think you can make a pretty strong argument, the best bullpen in the major leagues with the Yankees, and making it even stronger to shorten the amount of work needed by the non-Severino part of the rotation? And I think that's what the exercise the Yankees are essentially going through, Jim, now for the next 3 weeks, is they know they've got a real battle here to avoid a one-game playoff, to try to beat out the Red Sox to at least get into a division series. but they also know they have a team that's probably good enough to win a couple of series and maybe even a championship in October. And so they want to do everything possible to maximize that without too badly damaging their near future. And I think that's all the balls that Brian Cashman is juggling, trying to figure out what to do here now over the next 3 weeks.
Joel Sherman joining us. All right, so a lot to unpack there, Joel. As you pointed out also, if we go back to the offseason, the Yankees inquired about Giancarlo Stanton, but it was not a real need at that time. Then they made the move because the Stanton market collapsed and they were able to get a good deal. Could you see a deal for Machado following a similar path, or is there just too much interest in him?
Yeah, so I think there will be some similarities, Jim. I mean, Brian Cashman, his greatest success as a trader to a large degree is his patience. He's willing and his ability to see the field and see like, is this market going to collapse? And if so, are we going to be sitting here as the team with the money and the prospects, but not as much money and prospects that we thought might have been needed in the first place? It's almost exactly what happened in the Stanton situation, where it was like, it was kind of going to be the Yankees or nothing for the Marlins. And rather than get nothing and run the risk of continuing to pay the highest, you know, largest contract in history, the Marlins traded him to the Yankees. There's a lot of examples of that with Brian Cashman through his two decades plus of being the GM. I don't think this market will completely collapse, because even if we say a walk-year position player in this age in baseball doesn't get as much as it used to. Think about J.D. Martinez last year going from Detroit to Arizona for three very middling prospects. The thing that would be different between Machado and, say, Martinez is he plays a more valuable position, either shortstop or he'd have to play third base for the Yankees as much as he might protest against it. And I think as opposed to Martinez, there are a couple of teams that see how Machado could really impact the rest of the season. Arizona again, the Dodgers, perhaps the Indians, the Phillies, the Yankees, perhaps the Braves. So all you need is a couple of teams, even bidding it up a little. I don't know that you'll get 100 cents on the dollar for someone as talented as Machado, but you'll get something more than J.D. Martinez brought.
Joel Sherman joining us. All right, Joel, let me get your thoughts on what's going on out here in the Los Angeles Angels situation. They're two games over 500. They're currently 10 games out of a wild card spot. They've had a ton of injuries this year. So where do you think the Angels are right now as the trade deadline approaches? And then how big of an impact could they play in trade talks?
Yeah, I think they're in one of the worst positions you could be in. They're over 500, which usually gives you a sense you're in it, but I think if you looked at it from 20,000 feet, you'd say they got five more games this month against Seattle. They won the game yesterday. I think if they don't run the field on it, 6-0, maybe 5-1, begin to make a real serious crack in this. How would they begin to make up that ground? Plus, by not playing great, they've let Oakland get ahead of them in the wild card standings. Amazingly, they've let the Tampa Bay Rays get ahead of them in the standings. So that's, they're not in a great place, but they have Mike Trout, and, part of every discussion is context. And one of the things you're always thinking with the Angels is, what do we have to do to make sure we keep this guy beyond 2020 when his contract runs out? And I think at some point for a team that in his first six seasons, when he was clearly the best player in the sport, only played in one playoff series, they're going to have to show the ability to win in some kind of serial way, so it's hard to become sellers. And by the way, even if they wanted to become sellers, the most obvious valuable thing they had to sell got hurt again last night in Garrett Richards. And so to me, that leaves them kind of like betwixt and between, not in a great situation. And so I kind of feel like if they can't trade Richards, they'll just do whatever they can to kind of like have an upset here and make up the ground.
We're talking to Joel Sherman. Joel, to that point, what about Mike Trout? I mean, it's another season where he may not play postseason baseball. If that's the case, how big of a loss is that from the perspective of marketing and growing the game?
Well, I mean, I would say this, Jim, and I know, you obviously do a show about all sports. What if I told you every year in the NBA, LeBron James never made the playoffs?
Sure.
Or Aaron Rodgers never made the playoffs?
Right.
At some point, that would be detrimental to the NBA, detrimental to the NFL. The things like the All-Star game and the postseason are the platform from which the sport sells broadly. There's a lot of passionate fans that follow year-round and specifically follow their team. It's the most parochial of our sports. So, you know, fans are very passionate, but like a fan in, you know, Southern California might not care what's going on with Milwaukee, but suddenly they'll notice it come October. Hey, it's the playoffs. Let's watch in a bar. Let's watch someplace. And to not have Mike Trout on that stage has been, you know, not only bad for the Angels, but very bad for baseball because he's, you know, he's our Mickey Mantle. He's a great player who we never get to see play the biggest games.
Joel Sherman joining us for a few more moments. You know, Joel, you had a piece over the weekend that I thought was great. You might become the first person in history to compare Bryce Harper and Jeb Bush. Lay this out for me. What are the similarities you see in Jeb Bush and Bryce Harper?
Yeah, I don't know if your audience is old enough but for me to make another comparison, but I felt a little bit like Evel Knievel going up over buses trying to make that comparison.
Man,
but,
I love Joel, can I interrupt? I loved Evel Knievel. I am old enough. That was my guy, so I see it working. I love it.
My favorite thing would be Frank Gifford running up in the turtleneck afterwards.
Right.
So my comparison was essentially we started to think about Bryce Harper's free agency like a presidential candidacy ago, like 3-4 years. We saw it coming on the horizon. He was going to finish this season at 25, so go out into free agency for his age 26 season. He was the first pick in the draft. He's a national player in a sport that doesn't have a lot of national players. He's as talented a baseball player as there is playing the sport, maybe aside from Trout, but certainly like beyond results, just unbelievably talented. And we've been thinking about, like, is he going to get $300 million, $400 million, $500 million? And now in this platform year, this walk season, like Jeb Bush, we thought was, oh, he's going to be, you know, the Republican nominee. And we probably thought that for 3 years before the election and 2 years before the election. And then suddenly he was running for the election. And, you know, he got termed low energy by Trump and it stuck and he couldn't win primaries. And suddenly the guy we thought was going to easily walk to a nomination was out. And low energy is like low batting average. Like Bryce Harper can't get that much over like about 215, 220 this year. It's been lower than that a lot of the season. And then the question becomes, do people see beyond the numbers? I talked to his agent, Scott Boras. You know, he's still being walked at a rate where the other team fears him. He's still a power hitter, you know, with 20-plus homers. His line drive rate is the same as it's ever been. So will other teams look at that and the potential to market and – the fact that he's still only 26 and he still gets the 300, 400, 500? Or have we been waiting for this candidacy that's never going to fire completely? Because the reality is, as opposed to Mike Trout, who we used to compare him to, Jim, like who's better, Trout or Harper? Trout is great every year. Harper's had one great, completely healthy season, 2015 when he won the National League MVP. There's been hints of other ones, or he's been having good years and he's gotten hurt like he did last year, but just one completely great, healthy season. And so you weigh potential and fame and great skill against that reality, and now all of a sudden, he becomes the most, what the column was about, he's the most interesting player for the second half of this season because it's his last chance to throw something up on the board to say, I am that $300, $400, $500 million player. And by the way, get the Nationals at least both into the playoffs again because they're not in first place and beyond the first round for the first time in his career for an organization, by the way, that either as the Montreal Expos or the Nationals has never even played in the World Series. So to me, there's a lot on his plate, and it makes him the most fascinating guy of the second half of the season.
No doubt. And the numbers do not lie. They're not good. He's hitting 215 for the year, 188 in June, 175 in July. So the second half is going to be fascinating. He is a baseball columnist for the New York Post. He is an MLB Network insider, Joel Sherman, my guest. Joel, so good to have you back. Thank you very much. Always good to talk baseball with you, Joel.
And it's always good to talk to you, Jim. Thanks for having me.
You too. And I love an Evel Knievel reference. You know that. If you know anything about this show, you know I'm all about that. Dan in Denver. Dan, what's going on?
What's up, Jim? I wouldn't put too much stock in those Stucknut odds. They actually had me higher than Matt from the jump. That's a true story. But thanks for taking the call. I heard the Team Canada profile, and I had to weigh in. First, happy hump day. and a very happy Hackoff week as well, which kind of makes it Hackoff Hump Day. Probably somewhere in Canada, a star linebacker is making sweet love to a bulky mama's whatever it is. Yo, Jim, I'm like a Hackoff connoisseur. I loved it, which is why I love watching Matt and Tyler think they're strong callers and not realize everyone else thinks they suck. I'm sad it's gone, but I get my fix with those two guys and Jeff Passan. Watching Passan bring home third with one of the most incoherent calls in, quote, SmackDown history is like watching that kid with webbed feet take a handoff at the Cleveland Browns practice and run it 50 yards to the house while the defense pretends to miss shackles. Check that, Romy. The Browns missing tackles on purpose would be an upgrade for them. But you get my point. My point is Matt, Tyler, Jeff, if you don't think that's you, it's you. And, Romy, anyone else think it's so cute that Team Canada's clicked up like they're in high school? I mean, can't you just see these guys on the phone late at night, laying on their stomachs, hair in a high ponytail, a charcoal mask on, those things in between their toes after a pedicure? Tyler asks Matt if he's an hour two guy or still an hour one guy. The answer is neither. You both should do everyone a favor and call where you belong this Friday in the Hackoff spot. And Ty, I know you take the Smackoff thing really seriously, but bro, there's no weight divisions. Being skinnier than DJ Quails after a 30-day gum and water cleanse doesn't mean you get to fight in a lower weight class. But Rome, I heard you say that these guys finished 11th and 12th. You know who else finished outside the top 10? Parody Larry, Josh in Detroit, my accountant who doesn't even listen to the show. Seriously, Jim, it's like being rewarded for finishing the NFL season in the hunt. Anyways, Romy, you got to let me in at this point. I know I can finish outside the top 10, too. Out.
Dan in Denver. Man, this dude's trying hard. He's trying really hard. So do we give him a golden ticket? Yes. I'm going to say yes. You can have a golden ticket, son.
I've got a golden ticket.
Go ahead, Dan.
I've got a golden ticket.
Tyler in Edmonton. Tyler, so how'd that sound to you, bro?
It sounded good, man. Sounded good. My ego is at an all-time high right now. I'll tell you what, you probably will hear from me next week because that's kind of what I do. And I appreciate the kind words. I can hear all the losers on Twitter already, man. How are you profiling the 11th and 12th place guys? These guys are only in because they're Canadian. I didn't get the ice cream that I wanted. Listen up here, you batch of victim complex babies. I got 12th because I deserve to get 12th. I already threw that participation ribbon in the trash. But you know what I didn't do? Cry about it. I'm looking at you, Daniel. I'll give you props, though, Dan. You finally responded to the multiple times I put you in the ground over the last year. Anyway, Romy, I wanted to get things amped up a bit around here, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to step into the ring and offer all the guys who need it, which is basically everybody, some free-of-charge pre-Smackoff sparring sessions before the big day. You know, maybe get some of the undercard guys who might not get in, like Chad in L.A., or there's Caleb and Lef who are usually scrambling to make weight, so they might be interested. I don't know, Vic hasn't been really that relevant since his rivalry with Jay Moore, so maybe a new rivalry with me will get him back in the fold. I figure if everyone is going to scoff at the Canadians, then they shouldn't really be too afraid, am I right? And last thing, Romy, I have some Team Canada cheerleaders interested on taking a few picks to add to my montage for July 20th. I just want to throw it by you first and make sure it's all right if I sneak a couple of those in. Game recognizes game, my man, so I figure it should be no problem. Thanks again, Romy. I'm out.
Rock him. Tyler in Edmonton. Rack him and Ty, it's fine. Let's go to Knoxville. She's already got a golden ticket. Mona in Knoxville. Mona,
hey,
how are you doing? Good, Mona. How are you?
I'm great. I spent the weekend and a couple of days of this week with my remote area medical clinic, volunteer work. We give free medical and dental and vision care to anybody that shows up. And I think that's more important than acknowledging a Canadian. I mean, we really don't need to acknowledge them. We can humor them. But that's about as far as we can go with that. And I do want you to tell Lauren that if she wants to get a golden ticket, now that you taught her to beg, maybe you can teach her to sit up, roll over, fetch. I don't know. Whatever you want. And I know how I sound, and it's not from cigarettes. It's from radiation that I got after chemo. Big deal. I could be for real by the bench, too. And let me see about Vic. Oh, gosh. Vic, no class from NoCal. He was so insecure that he wanted to let everybody know that he knew what RSVP stood for. The only thing that's worse than Vic's French accent is my Southern accent. And as you clones must remember, always listen. This is not a free trip. Just because you get a golden ticket, that don't mean you're in it. I hope I'm still in it, because I got a lot more to say. And, you know, because this is a jungle, it's not a petting zoo. And I'm out.
Mona! You're still in it, Mona. You're still in it, Mona. Here is the second part of the Canadian duo, Matt in Vancouver. They're having a big hour. Matt, what's going on? How are you?
Trim, fit, rich, and I'm back for round two, Romy. And hey, Mona, we're going to win you over, baby. You'll be Team Canada soon enough. But hey, man, shout out to Alvin for that montage, dude. Alvin's incredible. He deserves an incredible amount of praise. But firstly and lastly, Rome, before I check in next week, I just wanted to say congratulations, Dan in Denver, on ripping a golden ticket exactly 30 seconds after Rome called you a bottom feeder, you roadkill roasting tool. I'll see you on the 20th, but I'll check in next week, Romy. Peace.
Rock him. Matt in Vancouver. We'll win you over, Mona. I said, how you doing? What'd he say? Fit, trim, and rich. Rich, fit, and trim. Who knows? Boy, that's a good last segment. So Mona came in, cracked on Vic, cracked on the Canadians, and took a run at Lauren because Lauren's been piling on Mona.
Good night now!